This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.
There's nothing spoken about that.
It's a highly idealized version of a mother, right?
So a mother is not given permission to be human.
Right.
And I think the most valuable part of someone who dedicates themselves to be of benefit is that they themselves are human working with their own confusion. We don't need more idealized martyr type people in the world. Sure. We need more humans working with the grit of their own mess.
Hello and welcome to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with David Nickturn on the Be Here Now Network. I'm your host, Michael Kammers. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and we sincerely hope that this podcast finds you as well as can be. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. As the title suggests, we discuss how to lead an integrated life involving spiritual practice, creative expression, and right livelihood. Our guide, David Nickturn, is a senior Buddhist teacher, successful musician, Emmy-nominated composer, author, and entrepreneur who currently heads Dharma Moon, a mindfulness-based education platform and global community. You can connect with us at dharmamoon.com to find out about upcoming programming, connect with us in community, and study with David. Also, we'd like to send a big heartfelt welcome to all of our new viewers on YouTube. While you are still able to hear this podcast and audio at all of your streaming locations, we're now live on YouTube where you can see what kind of a hair day we're having and your mirror neurons can fire as you see our faces. So if you feel so inclined, please head over to YouTube and check out the podcast there. Okay, so let's get to this week's offering. Welcome to episode number 26, The Way of the Mami Sattva with Jenna Hollenstein. Jenna is an author, mother, meditation guide, and she leads the Mami Sangha at the Open Heart Project. She's also an anti-diet dietitian who uses a combination of intuitive eating, mindfulness techniques, and meditation to help her clients move towards greater peace, health, and wellness. Jenna has been featured in Forbes, Wall Street Journal, U.S. News and World Report, Lion's Roar, and a variety of other prestigious outlets. Jenna is the author of a number of great books, including Eat to Love, A Mindful Guide to Transforming Your Relationship with Food, Body, and Life, and also Mami Sattva, Contemplations for Mothers Who Meditate or Wish They Could, which was published recently in September 2021, and which is the heart of the conversation here with David and Jenna. So, we sincerely hope you enjoy episode number 26.
Well, good morning and welcome, Jenna Hollenstein, to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast. It's wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So we're going to launch from your new book, which is, I know it's out because I downloaded the audiobook and I was listening to it in the car the other day. And it's you reading the book, which is also wonderful. The book is called Mommy Sattva. And it's, I think, unique book that is filling a niche, a space that has been long overlooked, maybe for centuries, maybe for millennia. So I wanted to, you know, ask you a little bit about the title, and maybe you could just tell us, what is a Mommy Sattva? What are you bringing together under that banner?
Sure. I was actually writing my last book when this title came to me. I was writing this book about like a Buddhist approach to working with the body and food. And I often get good ideas when I should be focusing on other things. So the title, like The Way of the Mommy Sattva, just like popped into my head because I had been leading this mommy sangha for a number of years. And we really talk about that meditation in everyday life kind of practice and how our sitting practice, most of us in the group have had a sitting practice prior to becoming moms, how it completely changes and it's interrupted if it happens at all, you know, but how there's this capacity to bring that same view and that same attentiveness and attunement to everything that we do. So there was this changing focus of like, what is true practice? And the word that just seemed to come up for me was, it was as if mothers became involuntary bodhisattvas, you know, like just by becoming a mother, you dedicate your life to being of benefit to yourself, but also, you know, inevitably to others. And so there, you can know this formally, you can know this consciously, or you could just sort of roll into it, but you're there.
Well, Jenna, let's dial it back just a little bit to, yeah, you're using some Buddhist terms, which most people in our crowd will be familiar with, but let's say there are some brand new folks in there.
Sure.
So you're combining your Buddhist studies and practice with your motherhood.
Yes.
And you're trying to bring those two things together for the benefit of yourself and for any other mothers and anybody who's sympathetic to mothers.
Yeah.
So I told Susan Piver, who is your mentor and leader of the Open Heart Project that you're, a participant in, that, that this is the largest gathering, the largest niche in the universe. And I said, you should use this as for your ad. You either are a mother or you have one. You must read this book.
Yeah. Can we steal that?
You can have it.
Thank you.
Because it's actually literally everybody.
Yeah.
And the only other kind of, presentation that would go to everybody is you're going to die.
Right.
So this is much better news for the other end of the funnel.
Yeah, definitely.
But so what is a bodhisattva that you're referring to? How would you define a bodhisattva, which is a sort of classic Buddhist term?
Yeah, and I'll offer a disclaimer and a claimer before I do that. My disclaimer is that I'm not a Buddhist scholar. You know, mm-hmm. I probably have a different understanding, maybe a more superficial understanding, maybe a more layman's understanding of a lot of these things myself, but they are very meaningful to me. And then my claimer is that the teachings have become so integral to my life that I can't not see the world through that lens.
Okay.
So when you say I'm merging the teachings with motherhood, I don't know how else to do it, you know?
Sure.
But what is
a bodhisattva? Just for the people out there who never heard that
word. Someone who commits to being of benefit to others. That's my understanding of it. And when I took, years ago, I took refuge to become a Buddhist because I felt like I had already become a Buddhist. So it was formalizing something that felt like it had already happened. But then years later, I was like, okay, so what's next? And this is very typical of where my mind was pre-motherhood. It was like, okay, what's the next step? Right. You know, in a very, very kind of linear fashion. And I talked to Susan, who you mentioned, who's my teacher, about taking the Bodhisattva vow and dedicating my life in that way. And she asked me why. And I couldn't come up with a better reason than it's the next step for me.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have the same relationship with that idea, what I understood it. You can never really know what it's going to be like until you do it. But then when I became a mom, again, I felt like something had already changed and I was formalizing it because I like ceremony. And, you know, I was formalizing something that had already changed for me in the direction of my efforts, in the direction of my attention, in my capacity to hold like love and pain at the same time, you know? So that's what that word has meant to me. And then the women that I connect with through the Mami Sangha, which is, as you mentioned, part of the Open Heart Project, they are all doing this.
Yeah.
They're all kind of struggling with the same metamorphosis, the same confusion, the same, you know, there's no manual. And the things that do claim to be manuals are not useful in a lot of ways because they discount that unique individual wisdom that we have.
Well, but just coming back to the Bodhisattva ideal, it's an ideal, right? In a way, it's like nobody could really do it.
Right.
But the specific ideal is it has two prongs. One is you renounce the notion of enlightenment until all others precede you into that sublime, level of understanding, if you want to call it that. And then, but the second one is you vow to attain enlightenment so that you're more beneficial in terms of helping others. Mm-hmm. So it kind of has it's like a double gauge shotgun. You're renouncing enlightenment and then you're also accelerating your own process. And it's kind of a wild ride because up until then, as you mentioned, you've just been working on your own practice and trying to get your head screwed on straight and trying to organize your reality in a way that is a little bit less compulsive, less neurotic.
Achievement-oriented.
Less whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden you're shifting your attention to others. And of course, then they use the model, and this is what really kicks up this conversation for me, of all sentient beings have been my mothers through limitless time.
Yeah.
And so they use the model of the mother. However, there's no manual for how to be a mother and actually be a bodhisattva. Yours might be one of the first books ever written on that topic in the history of Buddhism.
And they also don't, you know, there is this ideal of the mother, the compassionate, the unending patience.
Right.
But there's nothing about like the real shit hitting the fan.
Yes.
You know, there's nothing about when you hate part of motherhood. There's nothing about when your child frightens you because you think, oh my God, this kid is going to suffer in the world. There's nothing spoken about that.
It's a highly idealized version of a mother, right?
So a mother is not given permission to be human.
Right.
And I think the most valuable part of someone who dedicates themselves to be of benefit is that they themselves are human working with their own confusion. We don't need more idealized martyr type people in the world.
Sure.
We need more humans working with the grit of their own mess.
Well, and then the irony of it is that the idealized version of the mother that is used as the model for the bodhisattva is generated by men.
Right.
Primarily over many, many centuries.
Right.
It's just like a man's idealized version of romance. It's a man's idealized version of motherhood.
Right.
And then I can imagine, you know, and I have to imagine I have had a child, a beautiful child, and I have a beautiful granddaughter. So I have some experience with the process. And I would say that the younger generation these days, they're splitting up these duties of parenting in a very different way than my generation did, which is kind of very 50-50 for the caretaking role. So now I think many younger men or men who have sort of become more of the feminist kind of perspective would also get a lot out of your book, because they're going to go through some of the same things in the caretaking role of like, you know what, I hate this. This is boring. This is ruining my life.
Right.
And you're saying stuff like that, which is a lot different than reading a dreamy, idealized version of Tara, for example, about what the romantic version of motherhood. So I think it's really, really brave in that way. And there was one thing that you said, women can have OCD and they can have the fantasy of throwing the baby out the window. And for any mother out there who's had that experience and thought, I'm losing it here, I'm a bad person, for you to say this is actually something that can happen to anybody is a tremendously generous thing that people can recognize, as you said, the granular, the gritty aspect of motherhood. So
that is one of my compulsions, is to share the things, to externalize the things that seem the most awful and the most shameful. Because, you know, in the work that I do, I am familiar with the fact that so many of us suffer shame and feel isolated in the things that literally everyone else deals with. And so, you know, it's this really sad irony that we're all suffering silently with this. And when that happened to me, you know, you mentioned the idea of like throwing your child out the window. For me, it was like this vision that happened when I had this like tiny dependent person. I was in our seventh floor apartment on the Upper East Side, and I saw a vision of myself like dangling this child out of the seventh floor window. And it just terrified me, you know? And I've come to see it as a different thing than my initial response to it.
Right.
One that's really important is that it's a thought. And that what we learn in our practice is that we're not defined by our thoughts. Mm. And that at the same time, we can make space for all manner of thought. Mm-hmm. And then the other piece is a sort of awareness, because the truth is these children are completely dependent on us. Mm. And we are capable of doing awful things. Mm-hmm. So, but the awareness and the sort of being able to hold that in our consciousness, to me, means that we're even more likely to prevent doing harm, mm-hmm. because we're so conscious of the powerful position that we're in. And it doesn't have to be physical harm. It could be like that momentary withholding of love when your child is brokenhearted and feels remorseful about something. It could be that moment of like withholding affection that does damage, you know, as opposed to like forgiving easily and softening toward this person who's figuring things out and most likely saves all of their worst crap for you. Right? So you're the one in that powerful position to teach them both boundaries and how to be a good human, but also unconditional love and acceptance. And I will be there with you. We'll figure it out together.
And you're essentially saying that acknowledging, let's call it a dark side or kind of what most people would consider the negative dimension of our capacity to imagine different realities. By bringing that into the light of awareness, that you're actually mitigating, not causing, you're mitigating the possibility of enacting those things.
Exactly. I remember bringing this up to my therapist and her letting me know how many other mothers had shared this with her. And that was priceless for me to know. I had never heard of it before. Mm-hmm. And then I started talking about it with my friends. And at first there was shock. But very quickly after, there was, I have had fears that, you know, I was sexually abused and I've had fears that I'm going to sexually abuse my child, for example. Oh, so there was suddenly this space where before there was no space for that.
Mm.
It like ventilated these like secret places for people.
Yeah. That's, you know, a very important principle there. For example, where you're marrying and mapping into your Buddhist training, and especially in the lineage, you know, another thing that struck me about your book is it's very, you may or may not be fully aware of this, but obviously Susan studied with Trungpa Rinpoche, who was also my teacher and was also Pema Chodron's teacher and many people's teacher of this, mm-hmm. this generation. And the emphasis on, you know, kind of not spiritually bypassing or spiritual materialism, and actually having the kind of openness to every manner of experience, mm-hmm. was unique to him. And your language in there, I thought, oh my goodness, this is his particular perspective. It has been spread out so much into the foundation of Buddhism in the West.
Yeah,
that is stunning, because some of the language you're using, some of the framing, and it's basically saying the notion of making friends with yourself, of opening a negative negativity. Do you remember that?
I do, but I don't remember the specifics.
So that was one of the first articles that was written in like 1970 or 71. He's saying the negative, what we call the negative experience of the kleshas, are the manure of Bodhi.
Mm-hmm.
That was the exact expression. They're fertilizer of the awakening state of mind. But negative negativity, where you repress that and keep that down, should be cut through.
Yeah.
And that was a foundational kind of of this whole iteration coming through Susan and coming through you. It was kind of astonishing in a way to hear it.
Makes me think of I didn't do AA in my own sobriety, but I like a lot of their one-liners.
Oh yeah, the best.
And that reminds me of you're only as sick as your secrets, you know?
Yeah.
And to me, that's what makes Trungpa Rinpoche's teaching so trustworthy.
Yeah.
Is that they go there.
They go there.
Like that's my one wish in my life has been, before I could articulate it, to find people. Susan's one of them.
Yeah.
My partner can be one of them sometimes. Mm-hmm. People who will go there with
me. Yeah. Yeah.
People who are not afraid of ugliness, because we are capable of ugliness. Mm-hmm. We're capable of, you know, confusion. I think of it as confusion probably more than anything else, you know? But we can work through that confusion together.
Yeah. And then, you know, the perspective of dialing down or eliminating confusion, which is kind of the lower yana approach, mm-hmm. and helpful for people who are like strongly habituated, at a certain point flips over into, is there some way to transform this into wisdom, which is really, that's another core element of our kind of tradition.
Yeah.
Is you don't throw it out and, you know,
it's your teacher.
It's your teacher, but it also has enlightened wisdom embedded in it somehow, you know.
Right.
So the fact that there is no situation I've seen, maybe a teacher-student relationship can be very powerful and intimate. You know, we can talk about partnership too. That's a kind of interesting piece of this whole puzzle. Yeah, usually people go, you know, Jen, I wrote a book called Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck. And
I know, I have it on my shelf.
I didn't put it in there. You may notice there's a fourth very big topic that's missing. Relationships.
I have long been struck by the fact that some of the most wise, practiced, settled minds in the Buddhist community, it's like it all goes out the window when it comes to love.
Oh, that's, write that down. I'm very good at titles. You know, I'm a songwriter. It all goes out the window when it comes to love. That could be a country song.
Well, you can have that.
Okay.
I'll take the byline for our book and you can have that.
Yeah. It all goes out the window when it comes to love. And you know, it's like you keep thinking the hand is going to fit the glove.
Mm.
But if it doesn't fit, you must have quit. You know, so maybe that could be another book. Of course, our friend Susan Piber, and I think you know Susan's a dear, dear friend of mine. And
I
very,
do.
Very special friend. And we teach together, but we've been, you know, we've known each other for 30 years or so. And she takes it on.
I know.
That's she takes
part
on relationship,
of what I love about
like,
her.
Oh, Susan, you're going to get in trouble.
I know.
Don't do it.
I know.
But that is exactly where she goes. And the place to go, I think, is so Buddhist because it's expectation meeting, meeting what actually is true. And that is exactly what you're talking about with your mommy book. You have
it
expectations
is.
About it, and then you have what's really happening. So what's the good news about being a mom?
Well, I mean, just to pick up on what you were saying about Susan, one of the concepts that I love from her teaching on bringing the Dharma into your relationship is the idea of the projector, right? Like the projector mm-hmm. that we wear on our foreheads mm-hmm. and we direct it at whoever's, you know, relevant at the time. And we cast ourselves as like the hero or the heroine. And then everybody's supposed to fall into line according to the script. And, you know, that's so often done with our kids. You know, like I can see on a daily, any given day and sort of in an imaginary way, strip away all of the little projections that I would like to throw at my kid, you know?
Wow.
And the real challenge and the real beauty and what I wish I had and what I can't help but wonder what the world would be like if we all had is the idea of my role being to help him be exactly who he is and not needing to please me, not needing to grow into what I expect of him, not needing to starve the parts of him that feel too difficult or icky or unmanageable and nourish only the parts that are celebrated by our culture, large culture, our subcultures, our family subculture. So that sort of unconditional friendliness, that unconditional foundation, mm-hmm. I think that's good news because our kids come out with their temperament. They come out with their personality, you know, and they don't belong to us.
But when they're young, they look at you, they do something. I had a friend who said, who's very creative, very strong creative in the world. He said he remembered as a child, he had taken a crap and then he had painted with it on a piece of paper and made this thing he thought was extremely beautiful. And he remembered at the age of like 2 or 3 showing it to his dad and his complete horror, you know, that you'd done this. So, but they're looking to us when we're the parents for approval, they're looking to, and that really lingers for, I see that in business, you know, there's a lot of projection of the family dynamic in businesses.
Yeah.
People are looking for approval and for feedback. So how do you mitigate that where you're sort of giving them their head, but at the same time, you're giving them positive feedback or constructive feedback or what have you? How do you navigate that?
We all want to know, like, am I okay?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I'll tell you a little story to answer that question. My kid is, he's not an easy kid. He will never be an easy kid. He has this like perfectionism, this, you know, hard on himself kind of nature. He's explosive. Oh. And when he's not exploding, he's imploding. So I got him this really cool thing called Mightier, which is like a tablet and a heart rate monitor. And it's a form of neurofeedback. For kids, where they play video games and they're meant to get frustrated. Mm-hmm. And then the game guides them to bring their heart rate back into the blue range, out of the red and back into the blue.
Wow.
Consciously. And it's kind of a guided neuroplasticity in which the breathing themselves back into a regulated place becomes more automatic, right?
Is the breath how they do it?
The breath is how they do it. There are a couple of other ones, but the basic practice is the breath.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
And I started to see these changes in him, right? The first time we played miniature golf, it was a disaster. Yeah. Right. He did not want to be taught how to do it. And but he was really bad. And then he was really angry at himself for being really bad. And this is, of course, consistent with everything that I know about him, right? Because I remember him walking for the trying to walk for the first time and getting frustrated that he didn't pick it up right? So that was the first time. After a couple of weeks of playing this video game, Mightier,
right,
he said to my parents, "Hey, let's go play miniature golf." And they're like, maybe we should just get ice cream. And he's like, "No, I know how to control myself now."
Wow.
And he went.
How old is he, Jenna?
He's six.
Six years old.
Yeah. And he went and he played a game of miniature golf. He laughed at himself. He, you know, finished some shots for my parents. They had a great time, right? The same scenario played out the next day with me. He wanted to show me, because he wants that approval. He wants to show me that he figured out how to do miniature golf without a meltdown.
Wow.
But then several days later, he's playing Mightier and the games are getting harder as they're meant to. They're meant to bring you right to your edge. And he got so frustrated that he sat on the game and broke it.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, oh my God, my kid broke the emotional regulation game. What does this mean about my kid? You know?
Yeah.
And he was devastated.
Oh.
But to their credit, they scheduled a session with us and I invited him because he had a question.
Yeah.
And it was, am I the only kid who's ever done this?
You scheduled a session with the makers
of Mightier. Yes.
Far out. Wow.
And he wanted to know, right? Because this is to your point. I'm 46. I'm still looking for this. He wanted to know, am I the only one this has ever happened to?
Wow.
And this woman said, and I didn't answer that question for him because I said I couldn't answer. I don't have the information, but I knew that she would. And she's like, no, honey, the game is supposed to frustrate you. You'll learn how to work with your emotions. And so this is part of how I think we do this of, you know, I tell him, listen, yeah, you probably do get hurt more than other kids. We're a little accident prone in this family. Mm. Yeah, you do feel things maybe deeper than some of your friends. I don't see that as a problem. I see that as a strength. I love your sensitivity. Mm. I love your big heart. Sometimes it means that you can't deal with all those emotions and something, and then you explode or you say something you don't like. I mean, as of this morning, I was the worst mommy in the world, at least for 5 minutes, right? But when he understands that, then he can offer back to me some of that language. Like, I'm sorry. I think that I was tired or hungry, or I think I was getting hard on myself. And that's why I, you know, said something that I regret or whatever. I'm gonna try to remember to use my breath. You know, so he can be who he is. He can be this kind of explosive. I call him intensive, like intense and sensitive mushed together.
Wow.
He can be that intensive kid and he can learn that there are boundaries because all feelings are welcome, but not all actions are okay.
Let's slow that one down. All feelings are welcome, but not all actions are okay.
Yeah.
Is that the first time you ever said that?
No, I've said that to him.
Yeah, all
because I want him to know that whatever he can throw at me, it's okay.
You know, not
physically throw at me. Like whatever emotions he's feeling, whatever comes up for him, his rage, his sadness, his feelings of injustice, all of it is welcome.
Jenna, I see another book for you looming here, which is How to Train a Bodhisattva.
Mm.
How, as a mother, this is a really interesting topic. How do you bring a young person? Because, you know, what I usually say, people say, when can they start meditating and so forth as a Buddhist teacher? You know, the classic thing I learned is before eight, there's not a lot of point in it.
Right.
Even then, it's kind of make it into a game and so forth. And then, of course, a lot of our teachers go off and teach junior high school or high school age kids.
Sure.
But a five-year-old, what is the training, you know, for emotional regulation without constipation, you know, without stifling them?
Without
stifling it, And that is such an interesting topic. And I think a lot of conscious parenting is going on these days. It'd be interesting to give like a a Buddhist through line to that. I don't think it exists, to be honest with you. There is no training for children in Buddhism.
I know. And my question these days, and I don't have an answer for it, is whatever's happening right now normal for a six-year-old, just part of like the normal developmental behavior, especially given the fact that they do save up their worst for us? Or is it his temperament, his intense sensitivity, his perfectionism, his explosive / implosiveness? Or is it the effect of COVID? And, you know, the fact that the thing that we as human beings need the most to regulate our nervous systems, which is each other, we've not had consistent access to one another, right? Mm. And this kid, you know, he was in pre-K when COVID hit, so he only was in person for half of a year, and then he was home with us.
For a whole year?
For half of the year.
Okay.
You know, half of the school year. And then for kindergarten, it was very inconsistent. A lot of closed days because of quarantining, infections and stuff like this. Toward the end of the school year, you know, the spring semester, so-called, of 2021, they were back in school, but inconsistently. And they hadn't really built the same connections with kids throughout the school year because they were on Zoom. Mm-hmm. They did their best. And then we moved. Mm-hmm. And then we took him to Sicily for 3 weeks to see his, you know, my in-laws. And then he was in a couple of random camps. And now he's starting a brand new school.
Wow, so that's very disorienting.
It is disorienting. And so, but I think the question is always similar. It's like, is this age appropriate? Is this the temperament of my kid? Is this the circumstances of this moment?
And also, what about my reactivity to it?
Right? Because that's such a great point, because each of those moments, in our view, could be used as an opportunity for greater clarity and wisdom and compassion, or they can be used to shut down. And oftentimes, that question, that confusion, that not knowing gives rise to the shutdown because it scares me. Mm. It scares me. What if he suffers the way I suffered? What if he suffers worse than the way I suffered?
Sure.
You know, what if he never connects with his basic goodness? What if he never fully believes that no matter what, he is good? He has Buddha nature.
Well, what about this idea of the monkey in the middle, I call it? Mm-hmm. You look at your kid, and my son is 43, and this is still true. So, and then you remember, in my case, because my parents are pretty long gone, my dad and my son. I'm not thinking about myself now at this point.
Yeah.
And I'm noticing something my son does that reminds me of my dad.
Oh my gosh, genetics.
And then not genetics, but I go like, I was the pass through.
But some of it is hardwired. I do believe, I believe some of that temperament is hardwired.
Wow. But isn't it true that there's nothing really hardwired?
No.
you think we actually have hardware?
I do to some extent. Uh-huh. I think we are always going to prefer pleasure to pain.
Wow. We being who's that? Who's
humans.
That? You're not talking
humans,
about, you're not talking
beings.
About masochists, are you?
No, they would throw a curveball in there, but in a way, pain feels good to them.
Okay,
right?
So we're going to prefer pleasure to pain.
We're going to prefer pleasure to pain,
which we think of as pleasurable, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Which is a major obstacle to working with the Four Noble Truths.
Okay, so
right?
So
we have to deal with that paradox from day one. I am going to naturally prefer ease over struggle. But if I can't accept the struggle, I will struggle more.
But isn't it underlying that the truth is that we really are actually clueless about what is genuinely brings genuine pleasure and happiness?
Absolutely.
So there's delusion underlying everything that you just said.
Sure.
So that's where let me ask you this famous question, okay? You take your passion, aggression, and ignorance, which are our three root kleshas.
My favorite three poisons.
they're sort of the only three, and then you combine them in different ways. You put aggression and passion together, you get jealousy. You know, it's a little toolkit that you can play with. But when you look at that core underlying, people ask, what is the cause of suffering? So let's just, you mentioned the Four Noble Truths. And for those of people who don't know what that is, the first one, and it's one I'm going to be talking on another podcast about later, is the truth of suffering, or dukkha, as we say in Sanskrit. And then the second one is, what's the cause? Right. So first one, people say, wait a minute, no, life has ups and downs, it has happy and sad. And the Buddhists are saying, no, it's pervasive. The suffering is pervasive. Even in the good times, there's the notion of losing it, blah, 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 blah. Now, then you look at the cause of it, and there's a number of different answers. So this is like, what is your answer? What is the cause of suffering, Jana Hollenstein?
Resisting reality.
But wait, that wasn't offered. Was that offered as one of the three classic Buddhist offerings there? Because let me give you a multiple choice.
Okay.
Some people would say attachment. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. And some people would say aversion. Mm-hmm. And some people would say ignorance.
Right, but I see those all as fighting with reality.
Well,
because passion is often like grasping onto something even as it's dissolving, for example. Right. Aversion is pushing away something that feels too difficult to work with. Ignorance is numbing out to something that probably needs to be looked at, right?
Right.
So I think of all of them as fighting with reality.
Okay, and so then what's the source of that?
That confusion about what will bring us pleasure.
So underlying it is, you would say the underlying cause is some kind of confusion or bewilderment, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that technically we would say that underlies the three root kleshas.
There's
fundamental bewilderment. We don't know who we are, how we got here. And then we grasp at straws basically for the rest of the time. And also, punch holes in space. And dull out and space out for the rest of the time.
But we do have like these moments, I think, of clarity, right?
What does that feel like?
Well, so can I give you an example from my work?
Sure.
Because I work with people who, you know, struggle with eating and body image and things like that. And so, for example, if somebody has, you know, struggles with overeating, a common issue is that as a meal is coming to an end,
right,
and as the brain is receiving fewer pleasure signals because, you know, the body has these mechanisms that tell it when it's had enough,
right,
we sort of fight with that reality of the dissolution of the pleasurable meal.
Yeah.
And try to chase after the satisfaction that we thought we had at the beginning of the meal. And we're fighting with that reality, right?
Well, you could say from what you just said that the source of the suffering is attachment.
Yeah.
Because that's really, that would follow out of what you just said. I liked that feeling, that pleasurable feeling, and I can't get it back.
Right.
And I can see how attachment could easily be seen as, so how do you handle that with the person who's grasping at the early meal while they're eating the late meal?
Yeah. I think that.
What do you tell them?
I mean, offer them ways of feeling it, of noticing what's happening, right? Taking the somatic awareness and making it conscious, understanding that this thing is naturally dissolving, pausing, slowing things down, allowing there to be sadness, allowing there to be disappointment, allowing there to be those negative so-called emotions that we're always trying to outrun. And soften toward them, right? Susan uses this expression, expand to accommodate. Like, could you expand to accommodate the, you know, discomfort of something pleasurable coming to an end? Then you're really in your life.
Let me just repeat that. Okay. Expand to accommodate something pleasurable coming to an end.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. It's the definition of impermanence.
Right, right.
What about expanding to accommodate something painful coming to an end?
Yeah. Yes. Right. Because a lot of us get attached to our pain.
Why?
I definitely experienced this with I have chronic nerve pain. And when it first happened, I herniated a disc. I noticed that I got attached to my pain and I didn't notice even as it occasionally receded. I got attached to it at its worst, so I couldn't even appreciate when it had changed somewhat.
What about it were you attached to? What's
the certainty of it? I could see it. I could feel it. I knew that it was bad. I think it was an illusion of solidity and, you know, but it, yeah, I think many of us get attached to what we would consider negative experiences because we don't trust.
Well, but they also sustain a sense of identity, is what you're saying.
They do. They can.
They create and sustain a sense of identity, which I've noticed people can, you know, it's very tricky if you haven't had chronic pain to understand it. That's my personal feeling. You know, for example, you know, I remember being in a hotel room in Los Angeles and having a root canal on a weekend. And there's some unwritten law. I don't know who wrote this law. But when you have a root canal, it will be when you're out of town and it will be on a weekend.
And nobody's available.
So, and I remember the dental pain is, you remember that movie Marathon Man, if you ever saw it? It's a Nazi doctor and he comes to America, but they're trying to get a secret out of somebody who, Dustin Hoffman in this case, who he thinks is holding the secret. And he uses dental pain as, as the way. And every time I go to my dentist, I go, is it true? Because that's what he's saying to him. Is it true? Is it safe? Not is it true, is it safe?
Right.
So pain can completely explode and penetrate, as I'm sure you know, and most people know it from having it occasionally, but it's certainly if it's chronic, it's a whole nother level, can explode your sense of any kind of move that you could make to mitigate or modulate your state of mind.
Yeah. And just as you're talking about like dental pain, you know, I just took my kid to the dentist the other day and I'm just thinking about when he's in pain, not necessarily dental pain or physical pain even, but we have often resistance to the pain of those that we love because it's difficult to make space for. It's difficult to accommodate. Right. And that's, and often there can be a gendered aspect to it as well, with like boys being told like, don't cry. It's not so bad. You're fine. You know, things like this. I mean, cause he doesn't follow those stereotypical kind of roles yet. You know, he still paints his nails. He wails. He wants everyone to know when he's upset. You know,
he being
my son. And so, you know, I've been very careful from the beginning to make space for that pain, but I feel my own resistance to it. And I then have to work with it in the moment.
That's deep.
It's hard.
You have to be willing to create, what was the sentence we had? Accommodate, create.
Expand to accommodate.
Expand to accommodate your child's pain.
Yes.
Which is in a way harder.
Because that teaches them then that pain is not to be feared, right? Like it teaches some degree of equanimity. Not that he's not going to prefer the joyful moments to a moment that he's wailing about being hurt or about losing something or whatever, but there's not that twitchiness that, you know, the slightest discomfort sends him running to the hills type of thing.
Well, and the parent into a panic, which you see all the time.
Yes.
You see a younger child, like, you know, my granddaughter, you know, 3 years old, and they fall and they bang their knee or something like that. And before they cry, you know this very well. They look around. They look around at everybody in the room. Should I be freaking out about this? And, you know, everybody's going, you know, like,
right,
what should we do to try to consciously help this person? But you also don't want them to be upset.
Right, right.
And because it's uncomfortable for you, or it might be uncomfortable because you have company over. Or your grandparents are over, and then you want them to see how great a parent you are. You
know? I know. It's so tricky when there's an audience. Really tricky when there's an audience.
Being a mom.
Being a parent.
Being a parent, I mean, when there's an audience.
Yeah. Because, you know, so many people think of kids as an extension of themselves. And there's this like vulnerability when this extension of yourself is, you know, sassing you in front of your parents or something like that. So, yeah. But I mean, with the child who falls, you know, if they don't cry naturally, then they just get up and move on. If they cry because they're in pain, not because they see that we're worried and they know that they can get some snuggles out of it, you know, which I don't know, that might bring up something else. But if they cry because they're in pain and we come to them and we make space for it and we don't necessarily try to make it go away, we're going to want to make it better, but we don't need to make it go away. We can say, you know, that happens to me all the time. You know, it stinks when you hurt yourself. It's hard to have a body sometimes. I mean, this is what I, you know, say to my kid, to just, again, put it within bounds to respond naturally and have perspective, but respond naturally to what happens.
It's so hard being a parent.
It is so hard.
There are very few things that are, I called it the largest secret society in the world when we had our son.
Yeah.
Like nobody tell, there's no manual for this and nobody can tell you. And it's why you mentioned also in your book, the lack of community
right.
in contemporary life. This would have been something that the community would have shared.
Right.
You know, your mom would have lived down the street. She would be coming over. And some people still have threads of this left, but boy, by and large, we don't have it. Yeah. So the Mommy Sangha. Can anybody join the Mommy Sangha?
Yeah. I mean, we have grandmothers, foster mothers.
I mean, is it open to the public?
It is open to the public. You mean in, as opposed to people who are members of the Open Heart Project Sangha?
Yeah. In other words, is there a registration fee? Is there something?
Right. So
how do you get into the mommy? Let's tell people out there. How do you get into the mommy Sangha?
You go through the Open Heart Project and you join.
Okay. What's the website? Open Heart Project?
I think it's openheartproject.org.
Okay.
And if you are a member of Susan's Open Heart Project Sangha, that includes membership in the Mommy Sangha, but you can also just have separate membership in the Mommy Sangha. I think it's like $10 a month or something.
All right. So you want to join the Open Heart Project, which is a reasonable monthly membership with a lot of benefits, right?
Yeah.
And a fantastic community.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of offerings and things that support your being and your practice. And within that, one of the subsets is the Mommy Sangha. And you could join that tomorrow if you wanted to.
Yeah, you could. And
how big is it?
It's bigger than it seems because so many of us can't join live. Right.
Uh-huh,
so
okay, sure.
I don't remember what the number is right now. But a lot of people end up watching the recording because, you know, I'm on the East Coast. So we scheduled it initially for 1:30 in the afternoons. now it's switched to 1 o'clock because my school, you know, pickup schedule changed and I had to figure out how to be able to do both. But we meet from 1 to 1:30 Eastern time on Wednesday afternoons.
Every week. Okay.
Every week. I don't think we've missed a single week. I have missed weeks in which I've asked like other members who are trained meditation instructors like Beck Conant to offer instruction. But we've met every single week for the last 5.5 years.
Wow. And the mommies are meditating as part of that? Is it an hour? How long?
It's a half hour.
Half hour.
And we sit for 10 minutes to begin.
Beautiful. Right.
And then sometimes there's a reading, if I can organize myself. Sometimes there's just a little theme or something like that. And then we mostly connect with one another. You know, we're so strongly influenced by what's going on in the world. You know, we've talked about like eco anxiety. We've talked about the Black Lives Matter movement. We've talked about issues around domestic violence and raising boys versus girls. I mean, it's covered a lot of ground. And how to practice the principles of the Bodhisattva, how to practice the six paramitas, how to recognize, you know, those opportunities, those moments in everyday life for incorporating the mind of meditation.
Yeah. So the only requirement is that you're a mom and you're willing to take a meditative perspective on being a mom.
Yeah.
That's the requirement. I could just see that being huge. You know, it's just, why wouldn't somebody want to be a member of that?
I know. I mean, it's sort of like a best kept secret at this point, you know, because I think.
Well, we're blabbing about it right now.
Okay. So. Well, let's keep blabbing about it because I really do believe that there's power in mothers coming together and synthesizing the teachings based on the unique perspective that we have.
I told Susan this. I think this is a missing link in the history of Buddhism. This is a missing link, and and it's timely, and it's clearly delineated. You know, from a certain perspective, it's a kind of a no-brainer. You know, and something that I'm so glad you all are doing it. And what lingers is the and if I sum this up too precipitously, the notion of expanding. I want to just say that phrase one more time.
Expanding to accommodate.
What?
The full catastrophe of motherhood, right?
Expanding to accommodate the full catastrophe of motherhood. Maybe full experience because it's.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it as kind of a roller coaster. Or like, you know, an ocean type of thing where you're like riding the waves and sometimes they're calm and sometimes they're choppy and, you know, scary. But I mean.
Okay, but wait, Jenna Hollenstein, what about the upside of being a mom? Can you talk about that a little bit from your own experience?
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, my experience is that the best years of my life have been as a mom, and they've also been the hardest years of my life. And maybe the fact that they were the hardest years of my life have allowed them to be also the best years of my life.
And what's the best part? What's great about it?
The best part is for me personally, is the amount of compassion and like expansive, just understanding that I've gained in having this being that I am hardwired to find adorable, right? But there's something about what that relationship has brought about too. Like it's leveled me in many ways. And things that I thought that I had sort of worked out came back up, you know, and have to work with them again. But in a sense, the beauty for me is that I'm trying to raise him in a way that's compatible with my understanding of the teachings, in that he has this innate wisdom that however he is, it's good. He will be of benefit to others.
And is there a fun aspect to it? Have you had like kind of wild, goofy times that nothing else could have even touched in terms of how could anybody be even saying such a thing or doing such a thing?
Yes. I mean, you have to ask Susan, right? Because I text these things to her and some of our friends, like, you know, in the middle of the night before I go to bed or whatever, what Mimo has said to me today. You know, just the little things that he does, his sense of humor.
What's his name?
Domenico, but we call him Mimo.
Mimo.
It's like
Domenico.
A Sicilian nickname.
Okay.
So, I mean, like, for example, one day we were playing basketball because he loves playing basketball. He loves doing anything he really should not be able to do as a 6-year-old. So he likes to play at a regulation height hoop. And he saw these older kids kind of kicking this younger kid off their court because they were playing important basketball. This was an important game. So he says, I'm going to go talk to them. So he walks himself over, to this group of kids who were like, I don't know, 15, 16. And he's like, you know, when you were my age, didn't you want to play with the big kids?
Oh,
he's like, you shouldn't kick the kids off your court. You should let them take a shot. You should let them play. And these kids were like, who is this? And one of them said, okay, if you take a shot and you make it, you can play with us. And he takes a shot. He sinks it because he's my kid. And then he goes, I don't really feel like playing with you. I'm going to go back to my mommy. So he does these things like this.
Yeah,
you know,
that's an amazing story.
Who is this kid?
Yeah, who is this kid? It's the Mimo Lama.
Yeah, I mean, right. You know,
that is a great, great story. I don't know. Is that in the book anywhere? That's such a great story.
No, that just happened like a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
But I mean, just the dancing in the living room and the painting together. The latest thing we've been doing is playing badminton. And he just loves it because he's learning to laugh at himself and not be so hard on himself.
Badminton is the one sport where the harder you hit it, the slower the thing goes.
It's the best because he loves to just wail on it.
It goes nowhere.
But he can't break anything.
Well, also it just goes slower the harder you hit it. It's a ridiculous game. But
I know.
So let me ask you this kind of last zone. What's interesting to me about the book, among many other things, is the fact that you're addressing something that is so systemic. And this is a big popular topic these days, is what's in the system, not like what irritates me personally or what's could be a problem, not a problem. It's systemic racism, it's systemic sexism, it's systemic patriarchy. And you have to really think differently to think about systems. It's a different level of thought. You have to go so deep. So systemically, in terms of what you're experiencing as a mother and the kind of innovative perspective that you're bringing to it as a Buddhist mom, what would you change in the system? Let's say they give you the blueprint. You know, and it could be anything from the level of, you know, like, you know, supported childcare to time off, whatever, change the roles, the pay schedules, whatever you want to do. You're now the boss. What are you changing in the system?
I mean, on a practical level, and I do mention this in the book, I just think, what would it be like if mommy sanghas were as plentiful as AA meetings?
Wow.
You know, whether they were online, local, you know, hyper-local, themed, right?
Yeah,
because some of them have a specific theme. I mean, I could see mommy sanghas specifically for blended families or for people raising mixed kids or, you know, people dealing with sensory processing disorders or things like that. Like, how do you apply the Dharma to your literally hypersensitive kid, you know, who doesn't seem to fit with the other kids.
But it's specifically Buddhist Dharma, Buddha Dharma.
Exactly.
So in other words, that's kind of, what about I'm out here listening to this and I'm saying, but I'm not a Buddhist. I don't want to be a Buddhist. What's my
version? You don't have to be.
Okay.
I don't think you have to be, because I don't think of these teachings as Buddhist necessarily. I think of them as the truth. I think of them as the nature of reality. So how do we look through that lens when we're working with kids with special needs? How do we look through that lens when we're looking at the challenges of being an adoptive mom, you know?
Okay. So
this
is
Jenna, like a very practical thing.
Jenna Hollenstein, this is ground up work. You know, we're saying let's up through the grassroots, seep out and develop these communities much larger. What about any laws, any socioeconomic aspects that you personally, let's say we put you in power now, you have the power to change certain systematic elements. What would you change?
I think that work and school should be fit to the needs of the family. You know, I was speaking with a client the other day who is changing the way she engages with work. She's the president of a small company. She's learning, as we many of us did through COVID, that you don't have to be in an office every day in order to do your work, right? And the culture that she's created is respectful of moms. It doesn't infantilize moms by punishing them essentially for taking care of their kids.
Right.
And so the culture is flexible.
Yeah.
And it accommodates women who are responsible and who, frankly, I'm in awe of with the amount that they can absorb and get done, right? That shouldn't be necessarily what we admire and value, is like how much you can get done, but damn, they can get done an amazing amount, and they can do it in their own time. They can kind of take it on themselves to get that, you know, their work done in a way that allows them to be present as they wish to be with their families.
So it's the bifurcation of our work culture and our family culture. They need to be better integrated.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any such thing as work-life balance, and you know, in our current structure, and certainly not for moms.
Michael Moore has this great film about, he goes through Europe. Have you ever seen it?
I don't think so.
Looks at how different societies and cultures there, which are definitely more progressed than ours is in terms of exactly what you're talking about. This is food for thought. And of course, what lingers out of it for me is like, well, I just have this kind of mind. Your aspiration was just to saturate the world with mommy sanghas and work from the ground up. And maybe this is a masculine way of thinking, even, you know what I mean? How would you make that happen? To me, it would be letting people know about it. I wonder if are you guys really letting people know about this?
About the mommy sangha?
Yeah.
I mean, this is my...
It could be huge,
confession.
Is what I'm saying. Yeah.
I don't feel like I have had the bandwidth to promote the mommy sangha. I've had the bandwidth to show up every week.
Yeah.
Sometimes with a reading prepared, sometimes not. But I'm trying to keep my business afloat.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be present with my kid and not just the highlight reel of what's posted on social, I don't do. You know, I'm trying to stay in relationship with my partner and have friendships and things like that. I have an allergy to the word marketing. I don't know what it means. So I have not promoted the mommy sangha the way I feel like it deserves to be promoted, you know?
Welcome. Join the club.
Yeah.
This is a very ongoing conversation in the kind of transformational communities, is the marketing element of it being organic and generated by the fuel, but also with some savvy about how to get it done.
Right. But how do you keep the trustworthiness and the authenticity? Because oftentimes the savvy obliterates the trustworthiness.
It's such a current and relevant conversation on its own right. But just in closing, I just really want to reemphasize to whoever else is out there listening, you really should read this book. And not just for the moms out there, the dads and the men and the gender fluid and any, because everybody, no matter what, how you identify yourself, either is a mother or has a mother.
Yeah.
We haven't fixed that yet.
Right.
Now, maybe I won't be having this conversation in 100 years from now. And it's like when people are coming into the world different ways, but we all come into the world this way now. And the notion of expanding to accommodate the reality of the situation is so Buddhist in its essence. Mm. And it's so, I don't know of another example where it's been this well documented, tended to, clarified, propounded. So I'm just strongly recommending that everybody takes a little wing through the book. And then you can check out Jenna and our friend Susan Piper at the Open Heart Project, and we'll leave a link for that and for the Mommy Sangha. So thank you so much for joining our podcast. It was great to have you, and I hope that we can do it again sometime.
That would be great. Thank you so much.
There you have it, folks. Episode number 26 of the CSM podcast featuring Jenna Hollenstein. I'm improvising this outro monologue so I can actually make eye contact with the camera, which means it may get a little loose, but we've got new production values and it's an exciting time. So we're just on the seat of our pants here, riding the edge of the moment mindfully as we do. So what did you guys think about that episode? I personally enjoyed it very much. I thought there was a lot of wisdom on display there, as well as a unique viewpoint that we don't, maybe a viewpoint that isn't that unique, that we don't get to hear too much in the Buddha Dharma. So I really appreciated this. Little nuggets like, you're only as sick as your secrets from AA. Ooh, pithy slogan. Also, that Mightier game, I mean, if my nuclear family had had that emotional regulation device growing up, things might have unfolded a little differently. And now that I've mentioned this, it's probably going to end up as an ad in my news stream. But, spoiler alert, that's already happened because I talked about it out loud with my girlfriend once, and now I'm already receiving ads for it. So, it's recommended for people from 6 to 12 years old, but maybe I'll give it a shot as an almost 40-year-old because we could all use some practice, am I right? It's great to have the ability to recognize when we've met our edge and to come back, take some breaths, and engage in our mindfulness practice because mindfulness is an innate quality and mental factor that is always with us as wakeful, sentient beings. Well, that's probably enough for me. Now I'm just rambling and I'm improvising. Normally, we wouldn't do this on YouTube, so I could just do a bunch of takes. And then I would like edit them together in just the audio, but I can't really do that with the video. And I've got a busy week, and this has got to get in tonight. So, this is the outro. I sincerely hope it's been enjoyable, and that, is anybody still listening? I don't know. If you stick to it, sometimes you might find some Easter eggs in these. I have a tendency to release some music that wasn't included in the podcast because my aesthetic sensibility is quite different than David's, and the things that I do aren't always appropriate, but it's worth giving it a shot. Well, this monologue is still going. I also wonder, is monologist a word? You can hit me up at michaelk@dharmamoon.com and let me know. You can also email me there if you have any recommendations for things that you would like to hear David and I in discussion about in our David's View episodes. We've already gotten a couple, and we look forward to incorporating them in the future. If you would like to support this podcast and the Be Here Now Network, you can head over to BeHereNowNetwork.com/David. There's lots of great podcasts with David. You can support the podcast, the network, as well as all the other amazing offerings from t-shirts like Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg. There's an Alan Watts podcast there now. Not too shabby for company in the podcast universe. So, we'd like to thank Corey and everyone at the Be Here Now Network. We'd like to thank Melissa Mattern, our executive producer, for all that she does for us. And that's about it for this episode. So, thank you for tuning in. May you be healthy, happy, safe, and at ease. All the best.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/BeHereNow.